singing, just the hand claps.
Singing was good.
I liked it. Thank you.
Hi, this is Mark Ruffalo, and you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra.
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network in sports.
This is Tom Rowe live in Hudson this morning, and we're going to talk with Times Union's Roger Hennigan-Gilson in a few minutes, as we do each week, checking in on what stories he's working on in the Hudson Valley for the Times Union. And you've tuned in during our WGXC Fall Pledge Drive. We're asking for your help to become a sustaining supporter to keep community radio voices on the air. The one frequency that's open to the public is 90.7 FM, and we enjoy letting you in to your own frequencies. These are the public frequencies, we think. And we believe that they should be public and accessible. So that's what we try to do here. We try to get local folks on the air. We try to get lots of different voices on the air, diverse community voices. You can overhear other tribes. Consider making a pledge to keep it all going at 518-697-7400. Or go online to wgxc.org/donate. That's wgxc.org/donate. We will be back with Roger Hennigan-Gilson from the Times Union after the local news and the better weather. Stay tuned and consider going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you.
Stream runs through and the moon turns the blood. This is the network, network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network, network. This is the news.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, heard weekday mornings here at 8 o'clock on WGXC 90.7 FM. WGXC is hosting its pledge drive, and we need your support. Help keep hands-on creative community radio alive in your region by calling 518-697-7400. That's 518-697-7400. Or you can pledge online with your tax-deductible pledge at wgxc.org/donate. That's wgxc.org/donate. Help WGXC meet its goal and keep local, national, and international news broadcasting in Greene and Columbia counties. Thanks so much.
Wayfarm respectfully and humbly acknowledges the past, present, and future Indigenous peoples on whose ancestral lands Wayfarm and our radio station, WGXC, operate and broadcast. The Mohicans named themselves the people of the waters that are never still, following their arrival along the Mohicanitta, the great ebb tide river also known as the Hudson. The Mohicans stewarded this land over many generations in dynamic communication and interaction with diverse Indigenous peoples, including the Haudenosaunee Mohawk and the Munsee Lenape. Mohican descendants today live in communities in Ontario, Wisconsin, and Oklahoma. For further information on Mohican history and the contemporary community of the Stockbridge Munsee Band of Mohican Indians, please visit Mohican.com.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Upstate Films, where membership provides access to world-class cinema, first-run feature films, art house films, live music, and more, plus advance notice of close-up series conversations with directors and actors and other special events at the Star Theater in Rhinebeck, the Orpheum in Saugerties, and traveling around the Hudson Valley. Information at upstatefilms.org. That's upstatefilms.org.
Wayfarm's WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Neil Verma in Chicago, Illinois. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Daily News. Cassie Abel reports for Hudson Valley 360 that the Catskill Village Board of Trustees holds a public hearing February 28th to consider updating its short-term rental zoning law. The number of short-term rentals mean there are fewer apartments for residents to rent, making the affordable housing crisis worse. Catskill Village trustee Natasha Law said, and I quote, after a period of implementing and assessing the effectiveness of the existing regulations, we have identified areas where the registration and monitoring process for rentals could be enhanced for improved efficiency. While no significant changes are being proposed, we believe that these adjustments will streamline the procedures and benefit all stakeholders involved, end quote. In 2021, Catskill required short-term rental owners to obtain a permit and meet certain standards to operate in the village. Currently, a permit application to rent short-term in Catskill costs $500, and the annual renewal is $200. The public hearing is at 6:30 p.m. at the Robert C. Antonelli Senior Center, 15 Academy Street in Catskill, and you can read more about this story at Hudson Valley 360. Paul Kirby reports in the Daily Freeman that Democrats have a new congressional map to propose for New York after the Democrat-led state legislature rejected the bipartisan Independent Redistricting Commission map on February 26. A new map was supposed to be drawn after the 2020 census, but court challenges have kept the district lines changing, and candidates have now begun to petition to get on the ballot for districts that are currently unknown. Locally, the latest proposed map for the 18th Congressional District would add the towns of Ulster and Kingston, Saugerties and Woodstock, while Rosendale and Marbletown and the town of Rochester, Shawangunk and southwestern portion of Gardiner and a portion of Warrasing would move to the 19th Congressional District. Currently a Democrat, Pat Ryan represents the 18th District, while Republican Mark Molinaro represents the 19th District. Ryan said, and I quote, no matter where the district lines fall, no matter which Trump-picked extremists they run against me, the choice this year is clear. I'm running on a positive vision for the future of the Hudson Valley to deliver economic relief, to protect and expand our fundamental American freedoms, and to actually fix the problems facing our country, end quote. The new proposal keeps all of Columbia and Greene County in the 19th District, but removes all of Tioga County. The district also gains most of Rensselaer County, all of Otsego County, and loses a portion of Cortland, but retains all of Delaware, Sullivan, Broome, Tompkins, and Shenango counties. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman. Andrea Mako reports for Porcupine Soup that after a fire closed Dollar General store in Cairo last year, construction is planned soon to reopen the store. The company reported on February 27th, and I quote, at this time, we are currently finalizing our due diligence phase to rebuild our store at 29 Main Street. Based on our current timeline, we anticipate to break ground this coming week, end quote. The 9,300-square-foot store has been closed since last April. The store originally opened in 2014. And you can read more about this story at Porcupine Soup. And that wraps up the WGXE Daily News. You can visit our website at WGXE.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXE sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXE newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Thursday, February 29th. Local early morning temperatures range from 17 degrees in Tannersville to 27 in Rhinebeck. Regional average soil temperature is 38 degrees. We got a big swing around this morning. You'll feel those cold temperatures when you head outside. Expect some flakes to fall courtesy of Old Lake Ontario, and that should happen randomly all day long, but with no real accumulation expected. A high of 34 happens at 3 p.m. Overnight, temperatures fall to 23 degrees. But don't fret, though. Tomorrow will be dry and mostly sunny with a high of 48 at 3 p.m. Overnight, temperatures drop to 34 degrees and we see rain enter the area. It will continue all day Saturday and we get a high of 46. Sunday, things dry out and we get a high of 59. Time to get those gardens ready. Sunset today will be at 5:30 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:27 a.m. Looking way up, we see X-class flare chances are at 10%. Plasma winds will be average at 400 kilometers per second with a thin density of 3 protons per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 4 megahertz till dark, then fair below 28 megahertz overnight. There are no chances for aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 127. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate. And if you are looking for something fun and local to do, head on over to WGXE.org and check out the community calendar. See what your neighbors are up to, and while you're there, consider hitting that donate button. Help add to the crazy glue that helps hold us all together, and I do mean crazy.
All right, you have tuned into the WGXC Morning Show. I'm Tom Rowe here live in Hudson, and now on the line with us is Roger Hannigan-Gilson, the Times Union's Hudson Valley reporter, one of the Times Union's Hudson Valley reporter, and checking in every Thursday about what he's been working on in the paper. What have you been up to this week, Roger?
Living the life, reporting the news.
Staying out in the warm temperatures, except for today?
Yeah, it was pretty pleasant up until today. So, you know, that wasn't bad. But, news-wise. Over the last week, there's been a couple interesting things. There's a big project going on. It's been going on for, since like 2017 at this point. It's an effort to kind of build up, beautify, make use of the exit 21 exit of the New York State Thruway, which, as you know, across the river, it's in Catskill. And Greene County began acquiring parcels on the east and west side of the Thruway near the exit. In 2017, and they've been making a lot of steps recently. They're putting in a tourism center. They had kind of a visitor centers before, but this is going to be a huge upgrade. It being the capital region, it will be in an old Stewart's. It's interesting. There was a bit of a swap there. So Stewart's was, you know, located at this one place, still is. They are building a new Stewart's across 23B in the parcel owned by Greene County. And Greene County is, redoing the old Stewart's to make this visitor tourism center. And they're really psyched about it. It's kind of a major step for this project. And in the land that Greene County actually owns, the Stewart's is going in. I was down there a few days ago. The structure is there. They still have to do the interior and stuff. And then also a mid-sized hotel is going in, on the same kind of general plot of land. So they're hopeful that, like, the Stewart's will be completed and the hotel will be on its way in the next couple months. As I said, I was out there and, you know, they were doing site work for the hotel. These are two big plots of land. This is the smaller one. It's on the east side of the Thruway. The land on the west side of the Thruway is, like 86 acres. So there's a lot of land to fill there, but they're making moves there too. There's going to be a diner. The dining car is going to be in like a traditional like train car, like an old school diner, has been delivered to the site, but they still need to put in parking and that kind of thing. That's also upcoming this spring. So a lot of big steps are being made there. In other Green County news, there's Zoom Flume. Have you ever been to Zoom Flume?
I have, yeah. This is all, you're hitting all the Green County tourist spots today.
Yeah, I guess it was a week of that. But Zoom Flume, who, you know, it's not a nationally known park or anything, but it's certainly known around here. And I've been there as a kid.
It's one of the largest employers of teenagers locally in the summer, too, I think.
Yes, unfortunately. That's what they got caught up in. They were fined $38,000 by the Department of Labor for employing 35 15-year-olds between the summer of 2021 and 2022. I mean, they weren't employed the entire time because Zoom Flume is a water park and closed in the winter. But it's a bit of a nuance of DOL law. If you are below the age of 16, you are allowed to work in the country, but only if it doesn't interfere with school hours and as long as you're not in hazardous conditions. So, I mean, it specifically says, not in the original law, but in court decisions following it, that, you know, a 15-year-old can be a lifeguard, but they cannot be a lifeguard in the context of operating machinery or tending to rides or attractions that have machinery in them. So I guess the 15-year-olds, they had various positions as lifeguards, but one of the positions they rotated into two was kind of tending to the water slides. And there's a bunch of water slides at Zoom Flume. So, you know, they'd be the person at the top being like, you can go now, you can go now. Unfortunately, the slides are mechanical. You know, they have pumps on them to get the water up. And I think they have pumps on the slide themselves to keep the water flowing. So the Department of Labor contacted Zoom Flume and said that they were in violation. And then Zoom Flume, like, to their credit, immediately changed everyone's schedule. So no 15-year-olds would be in the top of the slides. But they contested the fine, saying they made various arguments, one of which was just kind of, well, we didn't know. And it is a particularity. But it went in front of an administrative judge a couple months ago, and he decided that the fine was appropriate. So earlier this month, this decision was made, and they're going to have to pay the $38,000, which I will say is not they pointed this out in the court decision, that a company could be fined up to $14,000 per Child Labor Act violation. And they were charged or fined just over $1,000 per, which equals $38,000. So it's not, for like 35 violations, it's not like a big fine. And I'm speculating to a degree, but one can conclude that the Department of Labor didn't view it as like a major violation, since the per violation fine was so low.
Since this is a Department of Labor issue, did they think of this as exploiting teenagers, or is it more of a public safety thing that the public was sort of in danger because teenagers were at the helm of safety, where they should only have been sitting, I guess, in those white chairs, not touching any technology?
Yes. Just saving people's lives. The violations were about like the teenagers, as opposed to about, the park, people going to Zoom Flume, because I mean, the law that they were fined under is like, you know, it's supposed to protect child workers, as opposed to protect people that go to various places. Mm-hmm. So, I'm not sure if they needed to make like a holistic argument, they were just like, well, this violates the law, and you know, that's how it is.
But as far as the public attending Zoom Flume has made the changes, and there won't be 15-year-olds at the helm of the slides, I guess, in a lifeguard.
They didn't return my calls, but the court decision noted that, like, immediately when there was contacted, they stopped doing it.
So it's safe to return to Zoom Flume if it gets to 60 tomorrow.
Yes. They might open for the one day. Let's hope.
All right. Any other stories you've been working on?
Something I'm about to release. I'll give everyone a preview. But the Hudson UBI program, that's Universal Basic Income.
There was something at Hudson Hall yesterday or something?
What's that?
Was there an event at Hudson Hall or something about this?
Yeah, there was an event last night I went to. And they showed this documentary called It's Basic, which is, you know, advocates for universal basic income. Apparently, more than 100 cities are participating in it right now, including L.A., you know, large cities. Hudson's actually one of the smaller ones. And some counties are doing it, too. Ulster County's doing it a bit south of us. But it was kind of an update about how Hudson Up was doing.
And why don't you explain what universal basic income is first, in case our listeners don't know what it is?
Yes. So basically the concept between universal basic income is, you know, if it was fully rolled out, would be get rid of any form of public assistance and then replace it with steady monthly payments to everyone. And that's not what Hudson UBI does. Hudson's UBI does. It targets people that need it the most, you know, lower income people. But basically, it's kind of a libertarian argument in that, like, Andrew Yang, who ran for president in 2020, brought this up a lot. It's just that it would get rid of, like, all the bureaucracy and, like, complexities of our welfare system and replace it with this one basic thing. And it's interesting to see what they're reporting in Hudson Up. One of the best, you know, because I've seen it attacked on certain news channels about being like, oh, well, why work if you know, you're getting this money.
It's the same argument as food stamps or welfare, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's their stance about any sort of public assistance. But, in Hudson's UBI program, in most UBI programs, it's about $500 a month. So, I mean, you couldn't quit your job. It's more of just, like, it helps. And also, at least with Hudson's UBI, the employment rates were, I believe, 27% before the program started, but they are now, or at least the last report, they were 50%. So, I mean, it's having the opposite effect, really, than what naysayers would say.
So that's good news.
Oh, yeah, that's good news. I mean, it's giving people that kind of a little bit of leeway, a little bit of breathing room to be able to, you know, have more positive economic incomes from other areas. And, you know, it was like explained in the documentary, like, if you don't have any money, like, how are you getting to that job interview in the first place? You know, problems like that.
Yeah, and it's not enough to cover your rent every month so you can quit a job, but people lose jobs all the time, and it's enough to help them cover the few months when they're trying to find a new job, or, you know, especially with the hardships you're talking about, if you don't have a car or what.
Yeah, it's not like income, it's more like making ends meet, at least in this iteration of it. And the Jane Institute did a report on it, which is very interesting, which I cite in the article. And I mean, a lot of the people chosen the program were the primary caregivers for people with, family members with medical conditions. At least two people had been badly injured on the job, and they weren't getting workman's comp yet. A lot of people, you know, these are...
And if they lived in Hudson, they have a hard time paying for their housing probably at this point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was brought up, too, just because housing in Hudson is...
So expensive everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, it's an issue countrywide, but it's especially an issue in New York and especially an issue in Hudson. In the report, someone was looking for a one-bedroom, and they were told it would cost $5,400 to move in. And they were just like, well, that's a no then. So it's a good place. Hudson is a very good place to have one of these programs because it's very diverse in a lot of ways and kind of a microcosm of America. And also it's just like really struggling with housing and cost of living increases.
Yeah, it could very well not be very diverse in a short period of time if economic forces wreak havoc.
That could be the case. I don't know what the numbers are, but I mean, you know, just anecdotally and just walking around, like, you know, that we're moving in that direction. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's an important local story that I'm sure will be continued to be scrutinized over the years as that program continues.
Yeah. And, but, you know, it's gaining traction nationally. I think I said, 100 cities, 10 counties, and they're all pilots. But, you know, I talked to Susan Danziger, who is in charge of Spark of Hudson, which is funding this program. And, like, she wants the federal government to take it up and it just be like how the country is.
Yeah, and can you imagine everyone got $500 a month and no one would be complaining about food stamps and welfare? I guess because if everyone is getting it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really point a finger if you're getting it too.
Right. So
you can't be like, well, yeah. Well, you are too, so. No,
I mean, you can be against the whole thing in theory.
A cultural problem that would be solved.
Yeah. That seems like it's a ways away. But these things happen much quicker than you actually realize sometimes. I mean, it was only 15 years ago when cannabis wasn't legal basically anywhere, and all of a sudden it's illegal, I mean, in most states now.
Yeah. So, no, I didn't foresee that as a teenager.
Yeah, so things can move very quickly sometimes. They move very, very slowly other times, but... We'll see what happens here.
Yeah, well, with the rollout of the licensing in New York State, you could argue that
it's both, yes.
Going slowly, too.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, anything else you want to mention this week?
No, but thanks for having me on, Tom.
Yes, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. Roger Hannigan-Gilson from the Times Union. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Have a good one.
I wandered in these big blue shoes till we had nothing left to lose. Nobody wants you when you're a circus clown. I should know. I looked all over town. Don't like my face. They make out like I'm some disgrace. But nothing's gonna change this painted frown. And I know I looked all over town. Somewhere they won't throw rocks at me.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul has signed new congressional maps into law. This comes a few days after Democrats in the legislature rejected maps drawn by the state's Independent Redistricting Commission. Lawmakers felt the IRC's maps were too similar to 2022 maps, which heavily favored Republicans. Rejecting those maps sent the state back to square one after the New York Supreme Court ordered the new maps be drawn last year. But Jeffrey M. Weiss, senior fellow at New York Law School's Census and Redistricting Institute, says the state's redistricting process was designed to fail.
It was based on a constitutional amendment approved by the voters in 2014 that was poorly conceived. It had faulty wording and left lots of loose ends.
He adds the amendment was specifically designed to retain the then Republican majority in the state Senate. Approval of the most recent maps ends New York's redistricting debate, at least for now. But Weiss thinks now is the time for lawmakers to work on making the redistricting process more transparent, with more public input and perhaps a new amendment to the state constitution. Voting rights advocates were equally concerned about the IRC's maps. Some worried they'd create districts where majority white communities could overrule the needs of minority voters. Rosemary Rivera with Citizen Action of New York says it would have taken power away from those who need it most.
People who are low income, people of color, who have a hard time accessing power to begin with, and then you begin to dilute their voice and vote, it becomes a problem in terms of what we truly want, which is an inclusive and representative democracy.
While some are happy the new maps unify previously disconnected communities, others feel more could have been done. Some advocates say several districts across New York City are still splitting minority communities, leaving them without as much power to elect candidates they want. This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
Hello, Willie Terry, your Roman labor correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk magazine. And I'm here today at the Black and Puerto Rican and Asian Legislative Caucus Weekend. And I'm here in one of the workshops where I have as my guest Dr. Timpe V. Champion. And she's at one of the tables here. And she wrote a book called Understanding Storytelling Among African American Children, A Journey from Africa to America. Now, how you doing, Dr. Timpe?
I'm doing fine today.
Yeah, I like your book. You know, you got to set up the cover and everything. So tell me about this. Why you wrote a book on this?
So this is, I wrote this book when I was doing my research when I was going to school for my PhD. And what got me interested in this, how we tell stories, is that I felt that sometimes black children were discriminated against on how they tell their stories. And that teachers were saying that our stories or our children were deficient in telling stories. So I looked up Africanisms and figured out that the way in which we tell stories come from a tradition. It just doesn't come from out of the air. And so that some of these stories that they said that didn't make sense or whatever is because they didn't understand our culture. And that a lot of the stories were performative in nature, so that just like when people preach in the church, it's a performative nature. And so some of those kids have been going to church with grandma, and so they know how to tell a story, how to keep people's interest. Another thing that I looked at was a lot of our stories also have to teach about morality. And so it's not just the purpose of telling the story, it's the purpose of telling the story because we're trying to teach somebody right and wrong. And so I came up with my own analysis on how to analyze kids' stories in school to show that our children can tell great stories.
And I want to ask you some more, but tell me a little bit about you.
So I grew up in Brooklyn, working class family, two parents, a father and a mom. I'm the oldest child of three. I'm the first child to go to college. Grew up in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. Also have had a brother that was murdered, you know, in the streets of New York, just shot down. Have another brother, but he left New York. But I, you know, grew up in Crown Heights, went to school in the community, went to a vocational high school because I was going to be a secretary before they figured out that I had a little bit, you know, education, and then decided to go to college. and got a PhD at UMass Amherst, where I studied with an African-American professor who worked on the language skills of black children. And so that's how I got interested in what I was doing. And eventually came back to New York to work at LIU Brooklyn, where it was a multicultural program, and I was trying my best to get minority graduate students in the program, which some people did not like, and so I had to retire early.
So you were tenured? They went.
I was tenured.
Oh, you was tenured?
Yes, and they went after me.
And they went after?
Yeah.
No,
because we got a new president who was after faculty. So she went after tenured faculty. You know, I made a deal and I went out. Yeah. But in doing that, I'm glad that I'm able now to just work with children, because now I'm able to work with children and, you know, go to children's home and, you know, work with my community, because a lot of people don't want to go into our neighborhoods. And I don't have a problem going into our neighborhoods to work with my kids. Yeah.
Now, who was the book written specifically for? Because I looked at it, it's like, it's nothing to do with reading. It's something that somebody who getting into the field.
Right. I guess, yeah, it's probably more for people. I think it's more for teachers. I think it's a good book for teachers to read. Because mm-hmm. They can understand what children bring to the classroom. So it's a good book for, children. And maybe some parents, might be interested. But I would say mostly teachers.
So how did you, do the research in terms of coming up with the idea that has stories to tell?
The reason I came up with the idea, because there was research that was done in the 80s on black children, and they were saying that the stories that they told were called topic associated. And I didn't like that term, because I felt like, what does that mean, topic associating? Why they called the stories that white kids told topic-centered. And so I didn't like the term, and, said, I don't understand why they're using that term, because I think, kids tell a really good story. So that's what got me interested in it. Yeah.
So you sit down with them and ask them to tell you?
You're right, to tell me stories, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, when I sit down with them, it's one-on-one.
Oh, one-on-one.
Yeah. That was just just to find a picture, yeah.
And I'm sure you got some interesting stories.
Oh, here's one. I'm asking a child, can you tell me a time when you were really scared? And this child said, when it was dark in my room on Halloween, because my cousin, he cuts the lights out. I wasn't asleep, but my cousin, he cut all the lights out. And and I started to scream, and me and my cousin, he kept laughing. And my mother, she told my cousin mother, and my cousin got in trouble. And then another time, when we went trick-or-treating on Halloween, and then my cousin, he was like, one of my cousins, he was like Freddy Krueger, and he had those claws. And I was scared, because I was scared. And last night, I had a dream that me and Tiara was playing outside in the dark in the middle of the night. And Freddy Krueger came and kept chasing us. And all my cousins kept running around, and I had a dream about that. So now, traditionally, when we're in school, when we ask a kid to tell us a story, they just want one event. And you notice in this one, she talked about three or four different things. But the stories were connected because it was all about being scared. So it still was one story, but she was telling a few things that happened that made her scared. And so, but a traditional teacher would say, you know what, you're telling me too many things. I asked you to tell me one thing. But I think, again, because of our culture, that she said, oh, I'm just going to tell you everything that scared me. And, if she was telling that to Grandma, Grandma would have listened to the story and wouldn't, didn't interrupt. And so I didn't interrupt her. I just let her keep going. And she was, one of the, best storytellers. And she was 8. I think she's one of the, this is a 10-year-old. Yeah, 10-year-old.
So how did you connect this to Africa?
So, okay, so I connected it to Africa. If I go back to the beginning of the book.
Because I know in Africa, they have griots.
Right. So, like I talked about, I start off with a story about the history of storytelling. First, we start off with like a Europe of creation story, which is in Nigeria. And then talked about also a researcher named Levine, and he said that the oral inventors are good storytellers who appear to have been relatively common in the black culture, was a source of delight and stimulation to their audience. Their narratives were interlarded with chants, mimicry, rhymes, and song. Levine also stated that narrative performance could include paralinguistic features along with body movement. And so that's, you know, that's some of the tracing back. And then most of, you know, African Americans come from West Africa. And then, you know, we talk about the stages of, you know, what happened and just about the analysis of the literature of why, you know, like black people told stories. So, like, here's an example of Dick Gregory. Okay, last time I was down south, I walked into this restaurant, and this white waitress came up to me and said, "We don't serve color people here." I said, "That's all right. I don't eat color people. Bring me a whole fried chicken." About that time, these three cousins came in. You know the ones I mean, Ku Klux and Klan. And they said, "Boy, we're giving you fair warning. Anything you do to that chicken, we're going to do to you." About then, the waitress brought me my chicken. "Remember, boy, anything you do to that chicken, we're going to do to you." So I put down my knife and fork, and I picked up the chicken, and I kissed it. So, you know, so this is showing how Gregory used humor to cope with racism. And so, and then it was suggested by Akapuhu, suggests that humor was also used within West African story as a technique to support or import a moral lesson. And so that's how I, you know, was doing the tracing back.
And it sounds like an interesting book. And, you know, and I think maybe, you know, teachers should look at that.
Yeah.
So how could one get a copy of it?
So the book can be ordered. It could be, it's on Amazon. It is on Amazon, but it's also, it can be ordered from Routledge. That's the company that publishes it. So you can order it online from Routledge Publishers or Amazon.
And the name of it is Understanding Storytelling Among African American Children, A Journey from Africa to
America. Yes.
Tempe B. Champion.
Champion, right. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here is Pharoah Sanders' Thembi on 90.7 WGXC. Ferrer Sanders with Themby on 90.7 FM WGXC.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I'm no longer the young man sitting in the back, hoping colleagues would remember my name. It's time for the next generation of leadership.
Republican Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the longest-serving Senate leader ever, will serve out the last 3 years of his term, but will stop being minority leader in November. The 82-year-old has suffered health issues of late, but he's also come into conflict with the dominant figure in the party, former President Donald Trump. The Supreme Court will decide whether Trump is immune from prosecution for trying to overturn the 2020 election. The court scheduled arguments in late April and at the former president's request has put his March trial date on hold. Loyola law professor Jessica Levinson tells NBC she expects the high court will uphold an appellate court's rejection of immunity, but it's new legal territory.
This is the type of case that the Supreme Court does look at. It's a big constitutional question. It's a matter of first impression because we've never been here before.
Illinois has now become the third state to kick the former president off the ballot for leading an insurrection. Meanwhile, a New York appellate judge has refused to stop collection of the $500 million civil penalty while Trump appeals that ruling. And former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley is calling on the Republican National Committee to bar the party from paying the former president's legal fees. More than one in eight Democrats in Michigan's primary voted uncommitted, enough to deny President Joe Biden two delegates. Dearborn Mayor Abdullah Hamoud says Biden's support for Israel's war in Gaza betrays the more than 250,000 Arab Americans in his state.
2020, we're promised a president who is going to bring decency back to the White House, who led with humanity. And what we found since the events unfolded on October 7th is anything but.
Organizers want Biden to call for a ceasefire. Robert McCall with the Council on American Islamic Relations says now they're focused on next month's Minnesota and Washington state primaries.
Our communities are organized. We're a political force in these states and other swing states, and we can tip the results in any election when it counts.
Congressional leaders have reached a potential deal on 6 of 12 annual budget bills, pending approval by the House and Senate, along with another temporary spending stopgap. That would avoid a Friday government shutdown, keeping it open into next month. But Pentagon spokesperson Major General Pat Ryder says budgeting this way hurts national security.
The fact is that this uncertainty undermines our military readiness and jeopardizes critical modernization efforts.
Meanwhile, the leaders of two dozen European parliaments are urging Speaker Johnson to pass additional aid for Ukraine. And the New York legislature has approved new maps for the state's congressional districts, including several that could be very competitive this fall. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. A Delaware Superior Court judge struck down two early voting laws February 23rd, affecting tens of thousands of voters who were approved for a permanent absentee ballot list and those who choose to vote early in person. Democracy Docket reports that the lawsuit was brought by a state GOP chair and the Conservative Public Interest Legal Foundation in 2022. They argue that Delaware's constitution allows only one day of voting, not the 10 days of early voting passed in 2019 and implemented in 2022. Over 55,000 people voted early in the last midterm election, 7% of ballots cast. In his opinion, Judge Mark Connor wrote, "Our Constitution provides only one such day, not any day or series of days the General Assembly sees fit." The GOP plaintiffs also contested a permanent absentee ballot request list passed in 2010 for which voters can qualify if disabled, a state employee, active military, or a caregiver. The permanent absentee list was passed with a bipartisan vote and now has more than 20,000 signed up. Judge Connor noted that this law, too, ran afoul of the state constitution because it added a voter to a permanent list without verifying future eligibility. While the state attorney general says she will appeal, Delawareans needing to vote by absentee should prepare to reapply for upcoming elections. For details, visit AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
I
have a house in the land to the north, one half of it red gold, the lower half of silver. Its porch is of white bronze, and its threshold copper. And of the wings of white yellow birds is its thatch, I think. Its candlesticks are golden, with a candle of great purity, with a gem of precious stone in the middle of the house. But for myself and the High Queen, none of us are sad. None of us are sad. A household there without old age, with yellow crested hair. Without exclusion, the house is not